Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. In 1989, just a short time before his death, legendary muckraking journalist I.F. Stone, who popularized the term "all governments lie," published his last book. It's called The Trial of Socrates. In the decades before, I.F. Stone, a political radical, cut his teeth covering government corruption. After being blacklisted in the 1950s for his leftist ideology, he started his own newsletter called I.F. Stone Weekly. He used this newsletter to expose McCarthyism and racism in the 1950s. In the 1960s, he is one of the first to question the validity of the Gulf of Tonkin incident, what was used for justification in the Vietnam War. In 1971, he retired from publishing his newsletter due to heart disease, but in retirement, he returned to school and earned a degree in the Greek classical language at the University of Pennsylvania. I.F. Stone was a lover of the classical Greek tradition, for its intellectual achievements and for its democracy. In his retirement, he set out to write a book about the history of intellectual freedom, which included but was not limited to a history of free speech. But the more he studied, the more he questioned, how could ancient Athens in the time of democracy, which valued free speech and which citizens were expected to speak freely in the popular assembly and in the law courts, execute, through the democratic process, the world's greatest philosopher, for corrupting the youth and disrespecting the gods? This endeavor led to the book The Trial of Socrates, in which he writes this, quote, "But the more I fell in love with the Greeks, the more agonizing grew the spectacle of Socrates before his judges. It horrified me as a civil libertarian. It shook my Jeffersonian faith in the common man. It was a black mark for Athens and the freedom it symbolized. How could the trial of Socrates have happened in so free a society? How could Athens have been so untrue to itself? This book is the fruit of that torment. I set out to discover how it could have happened. I could not defend the verdict when I started, and I cannot defend it now. But I wanted to find out what Plato does not tell us, to give the Athenian side of the story, to mitigate the city's crime, and thereby remove some of the stigma the trial left on democracy and on Athens." That mark on democracy that I.F. Stone referenced was a big mark indeed. The trial was immortalized principally, though not exclusively, by Plato, whose writings are the bedrock of the Western intellectual tradition. And Plato played his role in ensuring that democracy had a bad name for the next 2,000 years. Plato himself came from the aristocratic class and was likely inclined to be anti-democratic anyways. But it's also true he saw through this democratic process in Athens the execution of his teacher for basically talking on the streets. To understand the trial of Socrates, it is important to understand the years before the trial, in which twice the democratic system in Athens was overthrown, in 411 BCE and again in 404 BCE. By the time of Socrates' trial in 399 BCE, democracy had been restored, but attempts to do away with it were still strong in the public imagination. Before we get into these years, it's also necessary to quickly talk about the previous 100 years, which is normal in trying to understand anything historical. There were two major wars in the previous century in which the Athenian system, the democratic system, would reach its highest point and also its lowest point. The first is the Greco-Persian War, in which Athens would rise to dominate the Mediterranean world, and then 20 years later, the Peloponnesian War, which would bring a temporary end to democracy in Athens. In the first war, between 499 BCE and 449, Persia invaded Athens twice because Athens had previously supported a number of revolts in Persian-controlled areas. Cleisthenes' democratic reforms had already taken hold at the beginning of this war, and as the war lasted for the next 50 years, democracy, remarkably, continued to expand, especially to the poor. It was the poor that in great numbers were rowing these new kind of warships called triremes that made Athens' victory at sea over Persia possible. The poor were emboldened and demanded further political involvement, not so different than black American veterans who returned from World War I and World War II, and how their call for citizenship rights and voting rights would spark the civil rights movement. The poor who rowed these ships were instrumental in Athens in implementation of pay for participation in the democratic system. While the poor previously were allowed to participate, many didn't have the time to do so because they were busy making a living, making ends meet, farming the land, whatever it was, they didn't have time to go participate in these democratic bodies. So Athens instituted pay that was principally meant in order to further involve the poor in participating in these democratic bodies. It was important, and believe me, the rich hated it. They looked at it like welfare. But the seed of destruction was planted in the victory over Persia, which so often also happens in victories at war. Athens was a founding member during the war of what was called the Delian League, a military alliance of Greek city-states bound together for group protection. Think of it as an ancient version of NATO. After the defeat of Persia, the Delian League remained intact, and Athens became more and more powerful in it, to where it eventually dominated the League and used the League to grow its empire and its wealth. The other Greek city-states that were outside of this League would form their own alliance to counter it, and it became the Peloponnesian League, led by the military power of Sparta. Inevitably and predictably, this led to another great war that's remembered as the Peloponnesian War, in which the two leagues went to war for almost three decades. This is the second war that I'm talking about. Think of the Greco-Persian War as World War I, and then the Peloponnesian War as World War II, except Athens would not win the Peloponnesian War, and its loss would mean grave consequences in the years to come. Today we present part three of a three-part series on the history of Athenian democracy, the oldest democracy we have a full accounting of. Today we look at the decades before Socrates' execution, in which democracy, which was born out of class struggle, transformed Athens into a militaristic empire and forced its neighbors to submit to its will. This series comes in the midst of our spring 2023 fund drive. Today is part three of this three-part series, so today is the final day. And before I go any further, I want to come to you and ask you to support this radio program, support this endeavor, and support this radio station with a contribution that you can afford, one that is according to your means, and one that you'll feel good about as you go upon your day, knowing that you did your part. We are offering, if you're interested in a thank you gift, this book that played an instrumental role in getting in presenting this information these past 3 days about the history of ancient Athenian democracy. The book is by I.F. Stone, the legendary muckraking journalist, and it's called The Trial of Socrates. It focuses on this historic trial of Socrates in 399 BCE, but through the trial also uses it as a prism to look at Athenian democracy. It's an important book, I think, especially in our day. You know, Socrates was tried and executed after there were a couple of coup attempts, successful coup attempts against the democratic system. And I'm going to get into that in a moment. And I think the trial of Socrates is a fallout of how once democratic forces got back into power, how they probably overreacted, though I.F. Stone makes sure you see the context that caused that overreaction. But it's sort of one of those things when these kind of events, overthrowing democracy, kind of tends to bring out the worst of both sides, which I think is something important to think about today. We pick up the story just a year into this Peloponnesian War. The year was 430 BCE. The bones of the Athenian dead soldiers were laid out in a tent for 3 days, allowing the people of Athens to leave their offerings as part of the funeral ceremony that marked the end of the first year of the war. On the day of the funeral, the bones were placed in 10 cypress coffins, marking each of the Athenian tribes that were created by Cleisthenes, the founder of democracy. And they were marched in a solemn procession to the public grave just out the city walls. An 11th coffin followed, representing the dead soldiers that didn't make it home. As the remains were laid beneath the ground, Pericles, the democratic leader of Athens, stepped upon a lofty stage erected for the ceremony and delivered what history would remember as the funeral oration. Pericles said in a speech written down, or perhaps even written by, preeminent historian of the time, Thucydides, that, quote, "I will speak first of our ancestors. For when we are lamenting the dead, a tribute should be made to their honor. For they have handed down from generation to us today a free state. And if they were worthy of our praise, still more were our parents, who after a long struggle gave us this empire." and we gather here today to mourn the dead who gave everything to further improve our land. Our form of government is second to none. We do not copy our neighbors, but set an example for them. We are a democracy, for power is in the hands of the many and not the few. For in our hour of trial, Athens alone among its peers proves superior, for we have compelled every land and every sea to open a path to our bravery, and have planted monuments to both our friendship and enmity. Such is the city for those whose sake these men nobly fought and died for. The funeral oration became a homage to Athenian democracy and Athenian exceptionalism. You hear echoes of it today in American exceptionalism. The time of Pericles is remembered as the golden era of ancient Athens and democracy, even though it suffered a tremendous plague. It was a time that democracy was expanded in a time of great wealth. It's when the Parthenon was built on top of the Acropolis. It was a time of great intellectual achievements, and it was a time when Athens became the most powerful player in the ancient Mediterranean world. And with that power came hubris, and that hubris would help lead to its fall. All of this with the approval of democracy in the Athenian assembly. This became apparent in the later years of the Peloponnesian War. One such tragic event occurred that's worth talking about here. It's the conquest of the small island city-state of Milos. Milos was a neutral state in the Peloponnesian War, though it had ancestral ties to Sparta. But in 416 BCE, Athens sent envoys to Milos demanding that it submit to its rule or be destroyed. The meeting between the Athenian envoys and the Milian representatives would forever be known as the Milian Dialogue, and it would be taught in modern-day universities as an example of realpolitik. The dialogue was written down by Thucydides, and here is just some of it to give you a taste. The Athenian envoys requested that they be allowed to speak directly to the people of Milos, but the Milian leaders denied the request, saying they already knew by the Athenian military buildup off the coast that Athenians had come to conquer. Well then, let's save any flowery speeches and not go out of our way to prove our right to rule, said the Athenian envoys. You can save your city and yourselves by submitting to us now. The Melians responded, if you were to attack us, it would be a great injustice, and such acts would inevitably lead to your fall and would be left to history as a terrible example to follow. The end of our empire does not frighten us, said the Athenians. It is a risk we are willing to take. Now we have come here in the interest of our empire, and it is in our interest as well as yours to submit. Since you know as well as we do, justice is only a matter between powers that are equal in strength. When not, might makes right. And then the Athenian said these most infamous words, the strong do what they can, and the weak suffer what they must. The strong do what they can, and the weak suffer what they must. This sentiment has been at the heart of global affairs ever since, and probably even before. The ideology of fascism was born in the early 20th century in Italy, and the term fascism was coined by Benito Mussolini in the early 1900s. But if there was a single sentence that defined fascism better than any other, I would think it is this ancient sentence, the strong do what they can, and the weak suffer what they must. Perhaps we could call it proto-fascism. It's the same justification that the Roman Empire adopted in its conquest, and of course, it was Mussolini who sought to bring back the glory of the Roman Empire more than 1,000 years later, such as the motto goes, make Rome great again. The Milians responded to the Athenians, well then, if you are willing to risk so much to advance your empire, it would be cowardly of us, who are still free, to not do everything we can to reject submitting to your will. Not if you're well advised, replied the Athenians. The contest here is not an equal one, for we are stronger than you. It is in the interest of self-preservation to submit to our rule. The Milians then said, we are well aware of the difficulties ahead of us, but we trust that the gods may grant us fortune as good as yours, and the fortunes of war will change, and that Spartans will rise to our defense, too. You speak to us of the gods, laughed the Athenians. The gods rule by might. They rule wherever and however they can. We are not the ones who invented the rule of the mightiest. It comes from the gods, and anyone in our position would do the same. Do not count on Spartans to rescue you. Do not betray your own eyes of what's in front of you. Submit to our rule, or be destroyed. The Athenians then withdrew from the conference, and the Melians were left alone to decide their fate. After conferring with each other, they sent this message to the Athenians. A resolution, Athenians, is the same as before. We will not deprive freedom from our city that has been inhabited by our ancestors for the past 700 years. We put our trust in the fortune by which the gods have preserved it until now, and in the help of the Spartans. Meanwhile, we invite you, Athens, to allow us to be friends, and to let us live in peace. That will be mutually beneficial for us both. You have deceived yourselves, responded the Athenians. The Athenian navy created a blockade around Melos to starve the people. In time, the Melians were forced to surrender. Back in Athens, the question was put to the popular assembly of what to do next. The Athenians voted to send in the soldiers and kill every single adult male and enslave every woman and child. Athens then had its landless citizens colonize Melos. Here is an example of why it would be in the interest to vote for empire and the conquest. These landless people who were allowed to vote in the assembly now had the opportunity to sell off to Melos and colonize the land. It enriched the people. The massacre in Melos led to perhaps one of the earliest examples we know of settler colonialism. The strong must do what they can, and the weak must suffer what they will, was the same moral justification for European settlement of the Americas, both brought by democratic powers, both benefited the landless settlers. Back at home in Athens, the massacre at Melos left a bad taste in the mouths of some of the people. They developed a sense of guilt about it. At least some of them did. A year later, in 415 BCE, the playwright Euripides produced the play called The Trojan Women. It's about the women of Troy after their city had been sacked, their husbands killed, and their children enslaved. It contained such lines as these, quote, I too shall desert famous Troy, for when a town is destroyed and becomes a wilderness, all worship ceases, and there's no longer anything left worth a god's consideration. And this line, quote, when a man sacks a town and destroys everything, he's asking for trouble, the same destruction. That would actually be somewhat seen into the future, that last line. When a man sacks a town and destroys everything, he's asking for trouble, the same destruction. The place in Euripides' play is the mythical city of Troy, but it was understood at the time as a veiled reference to Melos. The conquest of Melos has ever since been seen as a dramatic example of Athenian democracy descending into a dangerous imperialist path that would even threaten itself, and that it did. The military victory over Melos produced more hubris in those who did not develop a conscience afterwards, and that hubris led to further military adventures. But these future endeavors turned disastrous. Case in point, the invasion of Sicily. Several hundred years later, the Greek writer Plutarch wrote that the proposal to sack Melos was led by a single individual by the name of Alcibiades, perhaps the most controversial man in the history of Athens. Alcibiades was an Athenian aristocrat and general. He rose to prominence when he publicly attacked and opposed a temporary peace deal between Athens and Sparta. He opposed trying to bring an end to the Peloponnesian War. He was considered one, if not the leader, of this new group called the Young Radicals. And though he used the democratic process, he was feared as being someone who would use this process and try to overturn it and to return aristocratic rule. The Young Radicals was a new political movement in this time that advocated war to expand the empire and further enrich Athens. This was counter to a growing sentiment, especially by the older crowd who had grown wary of war. This is also a time when more foreign forces were starting to turn against Athens. But the Young Radicals argued that it was better to rule than to be ruled. And this divide came to a head when the Young Radicals, led by Alcibiades, brought to the popular assembly a proposal to invade Sicily. and though the people of Athens were generally split about it, the proposal won the majority, and the plans to invade Sicily commenced. The sign of misfortune, however, rose immediately. On the night before the expedition set to sail, all the statues of the god Hermes, small statues most people placed at their front doors for good luck, had been desecrated throughout the city. It was seen as a bad omen for the war, and it was considered a sign of a potential coup to come. The blame for the desecration was put on Alcibiades, though he denied it. He asked for a trial, but his opponents refused to press charges, fearing that Alcibiades would gain the backing of the troops. Unlike our legal system, the law courts in ancient Athens were democratized. There was a jury of 600 people who would decide one way or another on any given case with just a simple majority. So a trial of Alcibiades could have given him the opportunity to rally the people, especially the troops whom he was popular among. But Athens became paranoid over the desecration of these statues that I mentioned earlier, and throngs of people were arrested and interrogated. Eventually, a young man by the name of Andocides, who gained immunity for his testimony, admitted his involvement in the desecration of the statues and named others who were also involved, including that of Alcibiades. Those who were already in custody were executed, and Alcibiades was recalled from Sicily. But Alcibiades escaped to Sparta, where he received asylum in exchange for helping Sparta in its war against Athens. You remember, Sparta has been instrumental in installing previously aristocratic rule in Athens. This is where the story of Alcibiades and the invasion of Sicily gets complicated and even confusing. But simply, after spending some time in Sparta, Alcibiades, who is remembered as this very charismatic and handsome figure, sparked up an affair with the Spartan king's wife and is then once again forced to flee. This time, to the other power of the Mediterranean Sea, he goes to the Persian Empire, where eventually he has to flee again, and he winds up back at Athens, where there is this uneasy truce and a lot of distrust. But in his final days, Alcibiades would actually surprisingly defend the democratic system. But that would be a story for another time. So why did the destruction of the statues of Hermes cause such a reaction, such an overreaction? Well, the story goes like this. Zeus was scared that the human race was about to destroy itself. So he sent his messenger, Hermes, to bring humans the gift of the art of politics. And the two gifts were shame and respect. And through these two gifts of shame and respect, humans should be able to work things out amongst themselves. But before he left, Hermes turned to Zeus and asked if he should distribute these gifts like he has previous gifts, by giving some gifts to some folks while giving others different gifts, just like some people receive the gift of artistry and others receive the gift of agriculture. Hermes asked if the gift of the art of politics should be given to just a few in the same way. But Zeus replied, "No. Give it to them all. All must share in them to make communal life possible." So previously, I've called the story of the tyrannicides, democracy's creation story of the gay lovers who slew the tyrant. But you could make a very good argument that this story about Hermes, Zeus, and the two gifts, shame and respect, in the art of politics, is really the creation myth of democracy. And you can also see that you can also see the value of democracy here, in which everyone was supposed to participate in it. Even the poor, I should say citizens, women were not allowed to participate, slaves were not allowed to participate, immigrants were not allowed to participate, but everyone who was deemed a citizen, even poor ones, were able to participate. And that is demonstrated in this mythical story of Zeus having Hermes bring the people the gift of politics and to give it to everyone, at least all of the citizens. And so it shows why it mattered that all of these small statues of Hermes that were put on in front of people's doors, that it mattered that those statues were desecrated across the city of Athens, and why it was seen as a potential sign of a coup to come. Meanwhile, the invasion of Sicily goes terribly wrong, and the young radicals, rather than being blamed for it, blame it instead on the popular assembly because they claimed that the assembly put out a terrible strategy to win the war. Also leads credence to their ideas that democracy is probably not the best way to fight a war, right? To do this on a democratic way. And so they blame the assembly. These young radicals blame the assembly for the war going wrong. And the young radicals in Athens began physically assaulting their political opponents and began committing acts of terrorism across town. And so the popular assembly was so cowed that in year 411 BC, it actually voted to dissolve itself and hand power back to the oligarchs. And the new power moved quickly to cement its rule. It began executing its opponents and it sought the military support to do it. But in a very surprise move, the soldiers resisted. They resisted this putsch attempt. Now, we are short on details of what happened next, but democracy was shortly after restored, and one of its first measures was to enact a law of capital punishment against anyone who would ever try to overthrow it again, which they would try again very soon. So democracy, through this popular assembly, would last for another 5 years after this attempted coup, but in 404 BCE, Sparta won the Peloponnesian War, and in so doing forced an end to democracy in Athens and installed a new group of oligarchs to rule. They would forever be remembered as the 30 Tyrants. And over the next 8 months, the 30 Tyrants, led by a man named Critias, murdered over 1,000 people without trial, confiscated property of citizens, and exiled many more. Critias, it is said, presided over a reign of terror that could only be matched in history by Robespierre and the French Revolution. But like Robespierre's reign of terror, it lasted in Athens just a short period of time, and so did the rule of the 30 Tyrants. The 30 Tyrants' extreme violent measures led to opposing forces to counter it, in short order, overthrow it, and reinstall democracy. And in the aftermath, in a city that had been truly devastated, Athens decided to pardon those who supported the 30 tyrants while executing the tyrants themselves, and again, it would restore its democracy. So as you can imagine, Athens was on pins and needles, and those who were a part of democracy's resistance movement against the 30 tyrants moved to charge the man who was the teacher of both Alcibiades and Critias. Again, Alcibiades, leader of the first coup, Critias, leader of the 30 Tyrants and the Reign of Terror and the second coup. And this man was a 70-year-old man with a fat turned-up nose, bulging eyes, and a big belly. A man who pestered everyone around town with incessant questioning. The man's name was Socrates, and he was being charged with impiety towards the gods and for corrupting the youth. And you are listening to Letters and Politics on listener-sponsored KPFA in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and KPFK in Los Angeles. Today is part three of a three-part series on the history of Athenian democracy. I want to quickly give you a fundraising update to where we are. Liza in Berkeley, one of our very own listeners, has put up $2,000 this hour. If we can match it, it would mean $4,000 for this hour. It would mean $4,000 for this radio station. It would also mean that at least in our efforts to raise funds in this special, today's the last day of this three-part special, if we can meet this $2,000 challenge, it would have made this effort a success as well, at least monetarily speaking. I hope regardless if we make it or not, there has been a sense of some value on the air of bringing these stories to the air. Again, what we are asking for is a contribution that you can afford, one that's according to your means, one that you feel good about as you go upon your day, knowing that you did your part. For a pledge of $100, I spent time, a good amount of time, with about 15 different books about this history. The one that stands out, the one that's most lucid, easy to read, and fascinating, it keeps your attention, was the one that was written by I.F. Stone, The Trial of Socrates. And it is about this trial of Socrates. And it is about looking at this trial and through it, seeing it as a prism to the story of Athenian democracy as well. I think a lot of these names, I got to be honest, before I went to Athens a few years ago to study this history as well. Before that, I didn't know these names. I didn't know the names like Cleisthenes and Alcibiades and Critias and Solon. Some people do know these names. I'm not trying to say nobody knows these names, but most people don't. And this is the first oldest fully formed democracy that we know of, 2,500 years ago. And this was a democracy, and this was a time that was actually debated at the constitutional system of the United States, at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, as an example of what not to do, because democracy was seen up to this point as rule by the poor, because most people are poor. And it was the poor who mostly ruled in ancient Athens during the years of democracy, and was a struggle between democracy and the aristocracy. And so the United States and its constitutional convention created a republic to make sure that there would be checks and balances on the passions of the poor. And that's what we have now. And that's what we live in today. We're not taught this history. And I thought it was important to bring this to the air. And so we're offering for a pledge of $100 this great book by Ives Stone, one of my favorites, The Trial of Socrates. The phone number for KPFA listeners in the San Francisco Bay Area, also for KFCF listeners in the Central Valley, is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. And in Southern California, listening to KPFK in Los Angeles, the number you're going to call is 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, and online at kpfk.org. Again, just quickly, Liza in Berkeley put up $2,000 this hour. At this very moment, we are about $500 towards that $2,000 challenge. So we're $1,500 away, but we still have time. We still have time to be able to make this, but I need your support today. If you support what we have tried to do here, if you support having this radio station on the air and being part of the public dialogue, the national dialogue, the regional dialogue, we need to see that support, because without your support, none of this is possible at all. For KPFA listeners, that phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. And in Southern California, that number is 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, and online at kpfk.org. We now return to the rest of the story. The Trial of Socrates, immortalized by Plato and Xenophon, is perhaps the most famous trial in history. It has forever been held up as an example in speaking truth to power. In Plato's Apology, Socrates says such lines as these in his defense: "Men of Athens, I honor and love you, but I shall obey God rather than you, and while I have life and strength, I shall never cease from the practice and teaching of philosophy. Understand that I shall never alter my ways, not even if I have to die many times. My plainness of speech makes them hate me, and what is their hatred but a proof that I am speaking the truth? I am that gadfly which God has attached to the state, and all day long, arousing and persuading and reproaching, you will not easily find another like me." Again, those were the words of Socrates as he defended himself in this trial. As he said, he is a gadfly. That's where we get the word gadfly, on the state, always critical of the state. So what's the deal with Socrates? What's he about? What's his backstory? Well, he explains in this trial that his acquaintance by the name of Chaerephon went to the Oracle of Delphi and asked the Oracle if there was anyone more wise than Socrates. And the Oracle said no. So Chaerephon tells Socrates this, but Socrates didn't believe it, because Socrates didn't believe he was wise. So he set out to find someone who was wiser than he, and he began to question all the others who thought that they were wise. But after interrogating these self-proclaimed wise people, he found that they too were not wise at all. They just thought they were wise. And he concluded that only he was the wisest, because only he seemed to see that he was not wise at all. But at least he knew he was not wise, hence he was wise. And hence he spent the rest of his days basically tearing up everyone's argument. Which, if he's tearing up your argument, doesn't make one very fond of him. And that included the ruling power of the day. Socrates was ruthless in tearing down this idea that the masses should hold power. He asked who should lead the ship when out at sea, an experienced, well-trained captain or the uneducated rowers at the bottom. of the ship or the untrained passengers? And he would say the captain, of course. And if you needed to build a house, who do you call on? Just anyone? Using the democratic spirit? Or do you call on a carpenter? And he would say a carpenter, of course. And Socrates would use these metaphors and extend them to the state. He also argued that democracy kept society from being able to get to the truth, that democracy kept created a non-truth, a post-truth kind of reality, that in democracy, politicians flattered the people and told the people what they wanted to hear rather than the hard truth that people needed to hear. Hence, a democracy never dealt with the hard issues that needed to be dealt with and ended up punishing the truth tellers. He argued that nothing was dumber than a mob. He argued that if you started telling people things they didn't want to hear, then you'd lose their support. And once you lost their support, you lost any standing and any influence in a democratic system. Socrates and Plato, who gives us Socrates' teachings in his writings, argued that the proper form of rule was to have a philosopher king. And if you couldn't have a philosopher king, then the king should, at the very least, be advised by philosophers like him. Now, intrigued I.F. Stone was, by the time that Socrates was charged, again, for disrespecting the gods and corrupting the youth, so it really could mean anything, he was already an old man. He was 70 years old. And Socrates had been talking about all of this in the Agora, the city center of Athens, for many, many years by this time. So why charge him now for corrupting and disrespecting the gods? Well, I.F. Stone concluded it was because of these traumatic events in just the few short years before, in which democracy was overthrown twice. And Socrates did have a connection to this, though it's debatable how strong that connection was. The first coup was led by Alcibiades, who was a student of Socrates, and the second, more dramatic coup that implemented this reign of terror that lasted for 8 months and saw the execution of thousands of pro-democracy supporters, well, that was led by Critias, the leader of the 30 tyrants. Again, another student of Socrates. Athens was traumatized, and in the state of trauma, decided to try its most famous philosopher and accused him of corrupting the youth and disrespecting the gods. And that leads us to this turmoil. I.F. Stone says that in Plato's Apology, which is Socrates defending himself, Plato ignores this context and makes the trial much more about basically people being angry with Socrates because he's always making others look foolish through his never-ending cross-examination, proving that no one is truly wise. They accuse him of making the good look bad and the bad look good. But beyond that, and maybe you can find a connection to what's happening with the democratic system, but beyond that, there is really nowhere to be found in this defense a single word about the two previous coups of the democratic system. Now, after saying all that, a word of defense for Socrates. Socrates never himself tried to overthrow the democratic system. In fact, he hardly ever involved himself in politics at all. He did not join the 30 tyrants. In fact, the 30 tyrants asked him to track down a pro-democracy supporter to be executed, and he refused to do so, instead saying he'd rather be executed himself than committing an unjust act. And he said he only survived his refusal to the 30 tyrants because the 30 tyrants soon fell afterwards. Even Plato, again, it's through Plato's words that we have Socrates and a few others, but really through Plato, was asked to join the 30 tyrants. He was asked to join the 30 tyrants, which his uncle was already a part of. Again, Plato comes from this aristocratic class. But Plato also refused, saying that the terror of the 30 tyrants' reign made democracy, which he abhorred, look lovely. It's recounted also that Alcibiades and Critias were attracted to Socrates not because of his political ideas or his anti-democratic ideas, but because just basically his ability to tear down another's argument. It was great theater to watch on the street. And thinking of that happening on the street, we should also qualify what is meant by calling Socrates a teacher and Alcibiades and Critias or even Plato as students. Socrates was just an old man who talked a lot on the street corner in the middle of town. He didn't have a classroom, or an academy like Plato, or a lyceum like Aristotle. No one paid him to do it. He was quite poor. Whoever wanted to come and hang out with him and listen to him on the corner in the agora could do so. But it wasn't like he was a professional teacher and these were his students that he was being paid to teach. So in the end, I.F. Stone concluded that it was understandable why Socrates was tried given the context of the day. You see it, you get it. You get what's going on. Context that we have been denied in telling of this history. But that it wasn't just. Like he said in that quote I read earlier, still could not defend what happened. It was a terrible mark for Athenian democracy. He was executed for exercising his free speech, and the trial brought out the worst in Athenian democracy. Of course, Socrates was found guilty, and he was executed by being forced to drink this hemlock. He didn't have to die. After he lost his trial, he was allowed to offer the jury whatever punishment should the jury be. And then, of course, Socrates is found guilty, and he's executed by being forced to drink hemlock. He didn't have to die. In the Athenian jury system, again, which people voted and the majority won one way or the other, in the system, the prosecutor recommends one penalty and the defendant recommends another. The prosecutor recommended death, and Socrates' recommendation, after he was already found guilty of punishment, was that he should be honored throughout Athens and have all his things paid for him for the rest of his life because he was such a valuable member to Athens and should be honored. Well, the jury did not go his way. They ended up, he had to pick one of the two, and they ended up picking death. In Plato's Apology, Socrates says this at the end: "It is not difficult to avoid death, gentlemen of the jury. It is much more difficult to avoid wickedness, for it runs faster than death."